The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
Live from the Space Talk Radio Studios, it's The Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting live to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here's the founder and host of The Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And welcome, everybody. This is the Sunday Space Show. Thank you for tuning in. It's great to be here. Trust me, it is really great to be here after some strange surprises at Uri's night at NASA Ames. And maybe at a later date, I'll tell you about it, and maybe I'll just keep my mouth shut so that I stay on the positive and up road. But let's get on with our program today, because we have two great guests and some very, very important announcements to make. For those of you who would like to call us and talk to our guests today, that toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, we do not use call screeners. Let the phone ring until we can answer it. Please be patient. We will bring you up on air as quickly as possible. For those of you who prefer to use email, those addresses are drspace@thespaceshow.com, thespaceshow@gmail.com, or you can use dmlivings@yahoo.com. And the screen name, for those of you wanting to use chat, remember with the AOL family, IMICQ or CompuServe, one word, space, show, chat. And again, if you really want me to use another chat program, send me your request. And so far, I've only gotten one request in making this announcement over the past year or so for a different program, so I haven't made any changes. But if I get enough requests for different programs, I'm happy to implement those changes. Please remember, everybody, the Space Show is trademarked and it's copyrighted. It's a registered service mark to me, but you do have permission to download the shows and put them on a CD, a DVD, a memory stick, whatever you need to do or want to do to send the files and get them out to other people to help explain why space is so important and why commercial space development is so important for us all. We are also an educational program. We support critical thinking and discernment. We do not support business plans. We do not help people raise money and do not construe passion and excitement for a business plan or a financial investment endorsement. That is not implied in any way, nor is it meant. Although we do support authors, we do support documentary filmmakers, and we do support professors and academics in their work. We just stay away from raising money and endorsing businesses. We're not in a position to do that. Visit our website, everybody, thespaceshow.com. Our comprehensive newsletter is there. It's uploaded every Monday. It has the details of the week's show, plus it tells you the future events, and then if we have to make any announcements or change a program, this is where you will see it first. The short form of the newsletter is emailed out on Monday morning as well, and if you want to subscribe to that, send a note to Dr. Space at thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is podcast. Remember, we're iTunes compliant. We're in Podcast Alley. Andrew at gigadial.net provides us with the podcasting. You'll find our RSS subscription URL on our website and both of our newsletters. And then, as I've been saying, we are completely archived, all programs. But if you have a media player that will not play a WMA file and you want to hear those initial 200 or 250 space show programs from 2001 and 2002. The Mars Society has archived them for us on their site as MP3s, and thanks to Alex Kirk for doing that. Go to our website newsletter up at the very top of the new newsletter that Mel conveniently and kindly remodeled for us. You will see breaking news, and there it will tell you where on the Mars Society website to find our archive programs in MP3 format, and also how to find out what the contents are of those programs. We have a store on our website. I hope you find it interesting and applicable to your needs. And then remember, we're a 501c3 with One Giant Leap Foundation. We do need your support. If you click on that button, it goes directly to PayPal. Space is not easy, and it's not cheap, and trust me, neither is a space radio show. So your support really is welcome. We need it. We encourage it, and thank you for doing that. Now, just a couple of other quick announcements, and then right into our program. Remember, it's a political season. Send your space thoughts, recommendations, and desires to the three presidential candidates and your members of Congress. I tout the Mars Society fax tool, but there are other ways to do it, of course. http://fax.marssociety.org. Contact them many times. You don't have to be limited to just one transmission. They need to hear from us all often. We are in Facebook. Mel monitors a Facebook discussion board. You probably have to be logged in to search, but you can search under The Space Show. We're in Twitter. And thanks to Mel, we now have a MySpace page. I believe all you have to do to check us out in MySpace, which is still under construction, but it is open for business, is go to MySpace, and it's / The Space Show. And again, we appreciate and thank Mel. Quick on hold the dates. Responsive Space in Los Angeles, April 28th to May 1st, and then ISDC and the Investment Summit, May 28th to June 1st, Washington, D.C. at the Capitol Hilton. And I'm not going to do any of the other hold the dates because I want to get directly into our program. We have two great repeat guests with us, some of my favorite guests and your favorite guests. Dr. Al Harrison is with us, and Al goes back to one of the very early space show guests that we ever had. He received his BA and MA in psychology from UC Santa Barbara, his PhD in social psychology from the University of Michigan. He, in 67, he joined the faculty of the Department of Psychology at UC Davis, and he is now Professor Emeritus. For those of you who watch the Discovery or the History Channel, you probably see him all the time on technically expert programs about extraterrestrial contact. They can't seem to play those cuts enough, and Al is a superstar academic in that. He has also authored many, many different books. He's been involved with SETI. His full bio is going to be on the website, but he's also been a science advisor to Bigelow Aerospace. And, you know, if you haven't read his books, search for them on Amazon and read every single one of them. Dr. Jim Pass is also with us. Jim got his PhD in sociology in 1991 from USC, and his specialty is deviance. And then he got uninterested in the topic almost about the time he graduated. And being interested in both sociology and space exploration, he put the two together. After reading Toff's web article entitled Positive Consequences of SETI Before Detection, lo and behold, he created a field called astrosociology, which is also his website for astrosociology. His full bio will be on the Space Show website archives as well. Time for me to stop talking and to welcome Dr. Harrison and Dr. Pass back to the show. Welcome, Jim and Al. How are you?
Good. I'm great. How are you, David?
I am fine, even though greatly disappointed at the treatment received at Yuri's night, but we'll do that at another time. But it is really uplifting and terrific to be here. And furthermore, just before the show started, I got a call from my friends at Celestis, and they're organizing the memorial services and the other things for the Falcon 1 launch, where Celestis has a memorial ashes package aboard, of which it contains my two dogs and my mother among everybody. And this is looking good for Falcon 1 on June 10th. And so that's really exciting because we've waited a long, long time for the third Falcon flight to take off, and it looks like this June 10th is going to be a good, hard date to work with. So
good
news on this Sunday, and terrific to have you both on the show. And, you know, I got to one day of contact. I loved it last week. It's just a powerful, great, warm, and informative conference with great speakers like Seth and others and yourself. I wish I'd been there for just more than Saturday. I missed your panel on Sunday, so why don't we start out and have the two of you tell us about your panel presentation that you made on Sunday.
Okay. Now, Jim, should I start by telling people a little bit about my talk, which was kind of the kickoff, or would you like to give them an overview of the panel as a whole?
We could go with your discussion of your presentation first.
Well, David, I agree with you wholeheartedly that Contact is a wonderful event. It was great to see you there and to catch up. We know that people have lots of commitments. We're sorry you couldn't be there for the whole time. I'm not sure how many listeners out there know about Contact. It's been going on for about 25 years. It was founded by Jim Fenaro, an anthropologist, and brings together lots of different people who are interested in both space exploration and the search for life beyond Earth. And it's adapted some over the years. Initially, there were a lot of science fiction writers that attended, some of them quite famous, but not many this year, aspirants, but not many recognized names. But what we do, what does happen there, is it brings together people from so many different fields, and it kind of melds the arts and the sciences. You may, if you're a real engineer or a space person or something like that, you may not like that initially, but what I've discovered is it's an absolutely first-class, wonderful kind of experience. For example, there was an absolute first-class professional piano player there, Phil Auberg, who gave a paper on Would E.T. Understand Beethoven and illustrated it with his wonderful music. So I've always enjoyed being part of Contact, and I have been part of Contact, I guess, since 1986. But what I did this year is I told the group about some work I'm doing with Brent Sherwood of Jet Propulsion Labs. We're on an International Academy of Astronautics committee on space architecture and design. You might be wondering what a psychologist is doing on a panel like that, and sometimes I do too. However, as a psychologist who's interested in space exploration and how people do up there, I'm a very forceful advocate of human-centered design, of coming up with various kinds of spacecraft and systems and procedures that provide the fullest possible support for the people who are up there, because they've got quite a bit on their minds as it is, without having to worry too much about the environment or what people at Mission Control are going to have to say. So I agreed about a year ago to work on the human factors, quote, module of the architecture group. And I got to work on that, kept putting more and more time in. And now the study looks like it's going to be designed around human factors. And I've been very, very lucky to be able to work with Brent Sherwood down at JPL. He's a first-class intellect, a first-class person, and a first-class architect. And like so many of the people in space, he has very wide-ranging interests that go beyond the most immediate topics. For example, I did not realize this, but he got his master's degree in engineering, and he wrote it on the prospects for SETI. And he told me that he thought he'd done a pretty good comprehensive report. This was, of course, years ago. And he said one Sunday morning, the phone rings, and he picks it up, and the person at the other end asks to speak to Brent Sherwood. And Brent says, this is Brent, who's calling, please? And he says, well, this is Sir Arthur C. Clarke. I'd like to talk to you about your master's thesis. Do you have time? And guess what? Brent had time.
I would think so.
Anyway, we're working together, trying to figure out what we can do to humanize space a little bit more, how we can plan for missions within the next century that are going to be carrying different kinds of crews up there. There'll be the professionals, the astronauts that we're familiar with. There'll also be passengers, tourists, and people on their way to off-world work sites. And this may be stretching it a little bit for the current century, but we're also looking at a third category of persons going out there, and that's the settlers. And so what my talk did, and I'm sure we'll get into details as this discussion continues, what our talk did was that we outlined what we're doing, where we're going, and what we hope to achieve, and trying to forecast the needs of these different constituencies and trying to figure out how to best accommodate them, using stuff that's if not off the shelf, then at least in the foreseeable future.
Okay. Jim, you want to pick up from there?
Yeah, I think it's important that Al and Brent kind of differentiated among the professionals, passengers, and settlers, because they all have different needs. And right now, you know, if you think about it in terms of the first 50 years of the space age, we've been dealing mostly with professionals. Obviously, we've had a few passengers on the space station, but for the most part, it's been, you know, a mission control, crew-oriented type of relationship. And as time passes, and now, you know, we're seeing companies such as Four Frontiers and others, Bigelow's project as well, looking toward settling Mars, creating space hotels, and so on. So we're getting a situation where passengers are starting to be more important to consider. And right now, you know, we basically focus on the physical natural sciences, and the whole idea behind astrosociology is to try to promote the idea that the other branch of science, which has been neglected, is also necessary in these deliberations and the plannings that go on. So we're trying to, you know, bring that forth.
Why do you think it gets neglected?
Well, I think it's partially due to the way that the space program started. You know, you had the right stuff kind of attitude where you had test pilots and so on becoming astronauts, and it just turned into a professional type of, you know, group that went up into space. And, you know, there's also military ramifications there and overtones. So I think, you know, basically it's something that was, you know, okay for the first 50 years. You know, the space program was able to get by with it because the social sciences, except for psychology to some extent, wasn't as necessary. But now when we're talking about non-professionals going into space, then we start talking about issues that are more relevant to social life, you know, that's similar to that on Earth, as opposed to having these professionals going into space. So the whole dynamic is going to change.
Al, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I think Jim's got it, but I'd like to add a couple of comments. If you look at the early space program, psychology was very heavily involved, and it came along with the work that was done with test pilots, high-altitude balloonists, animals riding in rockets, and so forth of the 1950s. Very extensive testing programs, training programs, psychology very much involved. But before Mercury was over, essentially certain areas of psychology, not all, the areas that we associate with personality, social psychology, psychosocial adaptation, clinical psychiatry, those kinds of things, it pretty much disappeared from the space program. I think a strong case can be made that it wasn't really to anybody's advantage, actually, to dwell on these issues. And in fact, some of the people associated with the Apollo program, you know, told their coworkers, hey, you know, we ought not to go off in these directions. We're going to be mission-focused. We're not going to worry about anybody's personal problems. It served so many purposes to neglect this. First of all, we had the image of the right stuff, as Jim said, which was very, very welcome. The astronauts sort of represented the best that America had to offer. People could identify with them and wanted to preserve that sort of that view there, and not hear about potential problems, drinking, marital issues, and so forth. Oh, sure, it was okay to drive fast and have drinks, but beyond that, it was best to preserve the image, I suspect. For the astronauts themselves, of course, by avoiding psychology, what you do is you avoid another possible means for disqualification for flight. You know, it's already tough enough with all these physicians going over you. You want to get kicked from an assignment on the basis of your response to some kind of psychological test. Well, meanwhile, while NASA was effectively ignoring the potential for difficulties in space, psychologists were beating the drum saying, hey, you know, things could go wrong. We've got to get involved. We've got to try to address these things before they come up. where I think the big shift came, okay, was in the basically was in the Astronauts on Mir program in the early 1990s, because up to that time, the demands of extended spaceflight, you know, mixed cultures, relatively large crews, being up there for long periods of time, that was not part of the American experience except for a very brief moment during Skylab. And what happened with the at about that time in the mid-1990s is that enough people came back commenting on loneliness or communications, the cultural issues or whatever, that NASA started taking this as a serious area and one that they had to take into account. And there's a whole bunch of evidence out there, I think, that shows that psychology became important towards the end of the last century, and more so in the first decade of this century. And one of these is the NASA's Bioastronautics Critical Path Roadmap, which identifies lots of medical and psychological problems that need, or issues, I should say, that need to be addressed now to assure good performance on return to the moon and a mission to Mars. Now, NASA's always changing, and things change, and I believe the roadmap has been replaced by a different document, but that too has the has that same recommendation in there. So what I've seen since I started working on this stuff with Mary Connors in 1978 in anticipation of the shuttle and space station Alpha or Freedom or whatever it was going to be called, is a real movement from sort of lip service and willingness to convene panels and stuff to really evident desire on the part of the space agency, and particularly the operational psychologists and psychiatrists down at Johnson Space Center, to get the kind of information we need to provide the support. So Jim's right that it got off to a slow start, but that there's much more in the way of opportunity and need now. It could shift again in a moment's notice. I understand that. But I think there's enough elements out there now that you're not going to see these topics neglected as they were for so many years.
We have a caller on hold, and I'm going to bring him up in just a minute. But what I'm noticing when I go to the conferences that have more of a focus on new space than, say, space policy or responsive space or something like that, is that more and more of the humanitarian aspects, the emotional aspects, and the human aspects, and I'm not talking about human factors with medicine like bone loss or radiation. Sure. I'm talking more about the psychological stresses are showing up more and more as discussion topics, and also as well with individuals just in, you know, networking and other types of private conversations. So I concur. It's not going away, and it's only going to increase in the percentage of time it shares with the overall space discussion topics. Let's
David,
see. Yes.
I just wanted to interject a little something about sociology and anthropology and the other social sciences, which have basically been less prevalent in terms of taking advantage of the existing and potential research and knowledge. And I think we should remember that psychological problems have social consequences in terms of how people interact and how a particular social group will behave and its potential for survival in the long term. So I think we need, one thing that I think we need to think about is to bring in the other social sciences, the humanities, and even the arts in conjunction with psychology, which has been, you know, at the forefront if you look at social sciences throughout the space program.
You know, that was the paraphrasing you, that was my lecture to the control freaks at Yuri's night last night. Guys, your actions have consequences. Do you not understand? You're trashing the media, which is here to support everything that you're doing. You know, but they're just oblivious like so many other people. Anyway, let's bring in our caller. And caller, are you with us? And sorry for the delay in bringing you up on the air.
Yes, I'm here.
And
this is Tom Gengali, and I was a member of the panel discussion on at Contact last Sunday.
Did you get a word in edgewise with these two guys?
Oh, yeah, sure.
What was your contribution to the panel? What did you talk about?
Okay, well, Jim, who mixed his interest in space with sociology and came up with astrosociology, and I mixed my my degree in aerospace engineering with my degree in international relations and talked about interplanetary relations.
Are we ready for that yet? We don't even do well on this planet's relations.
No, but there's certainly nothing wrong with planning for the future. And I was talking specifically about what governance on space bases, bases on the moon and Mars and colonies might look like in the future.
That is interesting. I'm just assuming, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure listeners probably do too, that initially it's an extension of the governmental force that put them on the moon or Mars or the near Earth asteroid. Is that a fair assumption?
Well, yes, but then we get into questions of international bases, just like we have the International Space Station. So, right now, when you've got just two or three people up there, it's not such an issue. But in the future, when you've got dozens of people at a base on the moon or on Mars, and they're living in a quite autonomous environment, especially on Mars because of the communications delay, then this raises some interesting issues as to how the settlement is governed and under what rules.
What do you think will happen?
Well, I think that on Mars in particular, because of the communications delay, you're going to have a much more autonomous setup than you would on the moon or in Earth orbit, obviously. I think that you would have the development of some sort of sovereignty, local sovereignty. So I think that there would be, not probably reaching the level of total independence from Earth, but a great deal of sovereignty over what we've seen up to this point, certainly, where, mission control is pretty much dictating every minute of a crew's lives.
What kind of questions and comments did you get from the audience for your panel?
I was asked about, how extensive local sovereignty would be. For instance, would a colony be able to claim resources over a large surface area of Mars, for instance? And I think the Outer Space Treaty is pretty clear on that point, that you cannot claim territory on the moon or other celestial bodies. You cannot control those resources by claims of sovereignty or by any other means. And that would include a sovereignty that was based in space itself, I believe.
Guys, any other comments from the two of you, from Al and Jim?
I'd like to add that another consideration is the idea that potential colonies or settlements or space societies, whatever you want to call them, will be actually created and run by private organizations as well as government ones. So that brings another wrinkle into the consideration in terms of, how will these be different than the government-run ones, and how will they, if there's more than one on Mars, let's say, how will they interact and so on.
Al?
Yeah, I want to point out that whereas I push psychology and I'm emeritus professor of psychology, I'm a strong supporter of astrosociology, politics, political science, anthropology, being as involved as much as possible in all of this. My degree is actually in social psychology, and at one point I took written examinations in sociology, and it's been kind of fun to work with Jim. We did a paper not too long ago on societies in space, where we were able to bring in a lot of sociological content, as well as a little bit of hidden psychology here and there. I'm a little bit stumped in that I remember it was a very lively discussion, but I can't quite put my finger on any specific question that was asked me during it, but there was a lot of interaction, a lot of interest, and it's very clear that the people who go to Contact do have interest in this kind of stuff. There's a very strong social science representation there, artistic representation, and they're very curious about, you know, this aspect of space as well as the technical kinds of aspects.
Here's a question for all of you or any one of you. Carl in Denver says, how many Contact conferences have there been, and how can you describe the evolution of what you're talking about today in 2008 from the very, very first Contact conference?
Well, I guess the oldest guy, so to speak, it was started by Jim Fanaro, an instructor at Cabrillo College and out around Santa Cruz. And the whole idea was, what would happen as an anthropologist? What would happen if we were to encounter some kind of alien culture? And for this to happen, I remember this is like 1981, and even SETI had not gotten very far in terms of involving social scientists, and astrobiology, per se, had not yet been discovered. What kinds of ingredients would there be? So he decided that, there would be, there would be social scientists, and there would be people who are interested in the technical aspects of space flight, but he also thought that there could be a lot that would come from science fiction, okay? So if you go back to the earlier conferences, they've always been sort of a mix of presentations, panels, and then workshops and exercises, okay? And the exercise, which continues to this day, using high school students rather than the other attendees, as it was early on, is to come up with a planet, come up with some species on that planet, and put together some kind of a scenario that would occur if people from Earth and cognizant beings from this planet somehow came into contact with one another. And they had to work on this in isolation, and then at the end of the conference, there would be this role-playing thing where you see what they come up with and how contact would unfold. The changes over the years, okay, and then the papers, they deal with life in space, and they also deal with the search for extraterrestrial life. The way that it's evolved over the years is, first of all, there's been a significant drop, almost total reduction of the number of big-name science fiction writers that would attend. Paul Anderson was always a big supporter of Contact. He's coming to give workshops on how to write science fiction, and you better know your science before you write fiction, that kind of stuff. Larry Niven came repeatedly. Vernon Vigne, I don't think I've got the name quite right. But there's a whole bunch of them. But they've kind of peeled off, you might say. What's replaced that, though, is artists and people who are interested in virtual realities, musicians. And so still a very diverse, kind of people getting together. What it needs is very clear. It needs an infusion of young blood. So anybody who's listening about a year from now, look for something called Contact 2009, NASA Ames, and think about giving a talk or giving it a shot. But that blending of social science, science fiction, and science is the characteristic of Contact, and that's what comes through.
And it's evolved since the first conference. Is it getting stronger? Is it getting a more popular of a topic?
Completely honest with you, it varies a little bit from year to year. There's always stuff that I just love. There's always stuff that, I have trouble with. I would say that it's gotten a little bit weaker in certain regards. One of the problems is that people a lot of professors would show up and they'd bring students with them. Jim had to bring 20 students or so. Reed Reiner from Northern Arizona University would bring 8 or 10 students. Even Doug Rayback from Hamilton College in upstate New York, his dean provided money for him to bring students. So that we're all retired. And so we miss having the students. We've got to try to figure out how to get more students. They've got the energy. They've got the interest. They have the novel ideas. Okay? I think that's been a little bit, it's definitely been a drawback of not having the main science fiction writers that we used to get. Stan Robinson shows up from time to time. It still happens. But I think that's sort of detracted. But, you know, at different points, I mean, people like Marvin Minsky have shown up, and Steven Pinker, and Ted Peters, the theologian who wrote books on theology and UFOs and stuff. And there's always something interesting going on. It is supported by NASA Ames and Chris McKay and some others in particular. It's reviving, as I say, with the arts and music and whatnot. But that we gotta get more people involved, younger people, and somehow deal with the fact that we're getting older, and so we're not drawing the students like we used to.
Gentlemen, hold it right there. We're going to take our first break, and we'll be back with our guest. 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. I'm the host of the Space Show, and our guest today, Dr. Al Harrison, Dr. Jim Pass, and Tom is part of their panel from Contact and is on hold, and we'll be discussing what went on as well, along with Jim and Al. But as host of the show, I'm going to do something a little bit personal for about 60 seconds. For those of you in Southern California, specifically in and around Santa Barbara, Ventura County, you've heard me mention my son Michael on air quite often, along with my other son, but this is about Michael, who is a filmmaker, recent graduate from UCSB Film School, and he has a production company called D's Guys, D-E-E-S-G-U-I-S, and they're doing a beginning TV comedy show that is pioneering in the UCSB college town. Everybody knows this. Al, you'll know this. Isla Vista, California. And it is this Friday, April 18th, Anseek Oyo Park in IV, and it's from 6 to 10 p.m. All of you are welcome, and you might have some good laughs, albeit it'll be college humor laughs. And you can get more information, www.deesguys.com. If you've never been to Isla Vista, it's a trip. You got to do it at least once in your life. If you want more information and you don't find it at deesguys.com, send me a note and I'll put you in touch with my son, Michael. Thank you for allowing me a little personal promo on the show. And let's go back to Tom and Jim and Al. And guys, who was actually on this panel? I know the three of you were there, and I can't find my contact brochure from the conference, but I know we had more people on the panel than the three of you.
Okay, well, I can read a list here.
Part of the panel. And of course, he's always a big draw. and Maryland, and I'm going to let Tom tell you a little bit about Maryland. He's had such extensive experiences with issues relating to space and people who deal with issues relating to space. And then a woman, Margaret Race, from the SETI Institute. Margaret's a biologist, and she's under contract to NASA right now. She's very much concerned about what she's working on is contamination. You know, when you bring back the samples from Mars, you're going to wipe out everybody. Or when you set foot on Mars, you're going to wipe out the you know, local microbes. So it was really quite a diverse group. John, would you like to say a little bit more about that?
I can talk a little bit about Dr. Marilyn Dudley Flores. She has a PhD in sociology. She did her dissertation on the third quarter phenomenon, which was at the time basically anecdotal. It was something that sociologists talked about, that they're just past the halfway point of a mission, and this included not only space missions, but polar expeditions, and you know, any time that you had a small group of people operating in an extreme environment. Halfway, a little bit past the halfway point of the mission, there'd be a spike in deviance, acts of deviance. And Marilyn was the first one to bring quantitative rigor to this study and to actually show from data that, this actually was happening. And she's written extensively on sociological aspects of extended space flight, long-duration space flight.
And, of course, she's been a guest on the space show. Jim, what have you to say?
We also had Seth Shostak on the panel, who is the principal astronomer for the SETI Institute. And so during the panel, we talked a little bit about Seth's desire to change the principles of declaration and contact if SETI succeeds. And he doesn't think that the current principles are adequate or to the point. So we talked a little bit about that. Also, for Margaret Race, discussing Margaret Race's interests, we had some email contact before the conference, and she's also interested in the societal implications of astrobiology and the decision making that goes into deciding how to control contamination and so on, and some of the things that might mitigate the proper steps taken to do that, based on things like religion and government decision making and so on. So, and we also discussed during the panel about students and whether students are really interested in space. And as we know, for the most part, space in the classroom has really been oriented towards STEM students rather than social science students. And so, one of our goals is to try to get space into the social science classrooms as well. Because as we've been talking about, we're going to need social scientists and really young social scientists to actually participate in space research.
I have a question for any of you or all three of you, according to Bob, who is in Salt Lake City. And Bob says, gentlemen, you make it sound as if the humanities and social sciences have been excluded from space by the engineering and science side. However, I am a political science graduate. I've taken quite a few social science and humanities classes in my undergraduate work, and I graduated only 3 years ago from Berkeley. I never once had a humanities or social science teacher mention space for anything. As far as I know, there were no prohibitions on them for mentioning it. I think the problem is the humanities field could give a hoot about space. I don't think they care about it. I don't think they know about it. And I don't think they know how to connect any dots from space to their classroom to their specific field. How are you finding space received within your own professions? Is it catching on? Is it growing? Is the problem one where engineering and science controls and therefore has all the feedback? Or is it possible that space doesn't appeal to the humanitarian part of academia?
Could I jump in real quick and give my take as an aerospace engineer, and then I could hand it off to Al or Jim?
Go ahead, Tom.
Well, the first few decades of spaceflight, we have been talking most of the time about very small crews operating for relatively short periods of time, a week and a half to the moon and back, at the most 13 days, I think Apollo 17 was. And I was also trained as a fighter crewman on F-4s in the Air Force, so I can also speak to the flight aspect and the flight training aspect of this. You are just trained to perform the mission. You're supposed to put your life on hold while you're training for and performing the mission. And for a short mission, you can do that. It's not unreasonable to expect that. As we get into longer duration missions, especially as crews become more and more autonomous, operating further and further away from Earth, that's no longer a viable paradigm, and we're going to have to shift towards a study of how small crews and even larger crews operate for long periods of time out on their own, much more alone than any group of human beings have ever been before, and that's where the humanities and the behavioral sciences need to start coming in.
Let me before it goes over to Jim and Al, let me bring that into something current. I was doing an interview with Buzz Aldrin last night at Yuri's Night before we were interrupted by the media staff at this great place and kicked out of the room. Can you imagine kicking Buzz out of a room in the middle of an interview? I never thought I'd live long enough to see that, but it did happen. And but anyway, Buzz was talking about his Mars Cycler approach to Mars and going to Mars to stay as a one-way venture and being able to live off the land and, all of the stuff that we hear about and talk about at conferences. And you see some real forward-looking papers written about, Bob Zubrin talks about. And he said something directly related to what you said, Tom. He said that if you go to Mars and you're expecting to return home, this creates all sorts of emotional and psychological programs about missing home, missing family, being homesick, conjure up all of that genre of human emotion and behavior that you can think of. And he said that will likely interfere, shorten, interrupt the mission, and the missions take a long time, and they're going to cost billions of dollars, and we can't have that. So what we have to do is to send people one way to stay, and when they know that they are home when they land on Mars, because that is now their new home, they will be learning how to build communities, do things together, do what they had to do when Tombstone, Arizona was being settled, or, some Mormon colony in the southern part of Utah 180 years ago. Because there is no other home, there's no place to go back to. So, is there any validity to that? And Buzz was talking about that. You'll hear it on the Tuesday interview. Does this sort of solve the problem that you're talking about? If we got sort of negated or did something with the return part of human settlement and made it one way, so that they were home and we had to build the future from that point going forward?
I think there's a great deal of validity to what Buzz Aldrin says. How many colonists at Jamestown ever went back to England or the Plymouth colony? They came to the shores of this country knowing that it was a one-way trip. So I think that that same paradigm applies to Mars, which, in terms of time, it's a similar journey. It's even a longer journey. It's, 6, 7, 8 months as opposed to a 3-month trip across the Atlantic.
Al or Jim, any comment? I mean, are we emotionally as humans ready to do? I mean, the technology can send us one way to Mars. I don't have any doubt that in a decade, that technology will be at hand if we want to pay the cost and if we want to do that with humans. Are we emotionally prepared to go one way and live on Mars?
We're willing to put up with, what, 40,000, 50,000 traffic deaths a year. I mean, that's part of doing business. Nobody's going to stay home, you know, because the odds for any individual is still pretty good. We're willing to drop bombs on people because of differences in politics, religion, or, you know, national interest, economies, what have you. But there's some part of human nature that when you focus on an individual case, okay, that it seems almost impossible to want to put that person to this. When you go back years to, say, the 30s, you know, when Floyd Collins was stuck in a cave in Kentucky, I believe, and, you know, everything revolved around that. Everybody wanted Floyd to make it out. Well, he didn't. There are people that you can find at any space meeting right this minute, if you produce some sort of spaceship that has gone to Mars and there's stuff on board to keep you alive there and you're going to stay there, you will find people who are willing to do it. But you will not find people, or you will not find people who are willing to just shut up and let them do it. You know, all adventure involves some level of risk. And what you need here is people who, you know, show that they can understand what that risk is and they're willing to do it. I'm not, you know. I remember back in the 84 case for Mars, the original case for Mars with Chris McKay and Carol Stoker, Tom Mayer, those people before Zubrin took it over. They had Jim Oberg was there, and they had a bunch of officials from NASA because this is where Reagan was going to give a positive signs on the space station decision. And Jim Oberg comes walking out to the middle of the stage, and he says, if the ship was out there right this minute, and you could walk out this door and go to Mars, and how many would do it? You know, every hand went up except mine. I probably should have thrown mine up, too. But I thought, hey, wait, folks, you know, you really need to think about this a little bit. So there's volunteers, but will we let people volunteer for suicide missions? I guess we do it in warfare. We do it sometimes in medicine. People certainly volunteer for suicide missions if you're a fireman or a cop, you know, or next best thing to suicide mission. But, you know, there seems to be this reluctance to let a few people go on before with a lot of unknown uncertainty and a pretty decent chance that you're not going to come back.
John in Montana sends in a comment, and Al, this is directly related to what you're talking about. Jamestown Colony took place in a different world. A lot of people seem to currently think that individuals cannot necessarily assume personal risk or especially risk for their children without some type of governmental approval or sanction. And that goes directly to what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's a real problem. The study that led to Safe Passage, Astronaut Care in the 21st century, I guess is what it is. And it's really about the return to the moon and the Mars and everything. But I know one of the people who was involved in that you know, said that there was discussion of one-way missions and things. And there were still things that didn't make it into the book, even into the final report, even in this day and age. And I haven't read it for a while, but I suspect one-way missions was one of the things.
Here's a yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to make a comment. As a sociologist, I think, you know, I'm a little leery about saying that we're going to send people on suicide missions or one-way missions, whatever you want to call them, without any possibility of coming back. Because if you have somebody who freaks out at the base on Mars, let's say, it's going to have effects on the rest of the social group there, and that may be detrimental to the whole situation in the long term, in terms of how that group is able to survive. And one of the problems I see probably happening is that we're probably going to do our first experiment on Mars, as opposed to, you know, doing something on Earth, because that's where everybody seems to be oriented. And I think we should let people have the chance to come back, only because we don't know how they're going to react in this isolation, because it's different even than you know, polar expeditions and so on.
Well, who's going to pay for them to come back?
Well, you know, that's we can offer it as an emergency basis or down the line. It doesn't have to be right away, but
if you're a
capability.
I don't think the colony would be best served by keeping somebody there that didn't want to be there. I think Jim is absolutely right.
Well, this is when you open the airlock, right?
Well, no, I think you have to have a more civilized solution than that. I suggest that we get back to one of the earlier callers' questions about the disconnect between the social sciences and space exploration, because I think Jim has a lot to say about that.
Well, let me give a listener comment first. And then you guys can take it wherever you want to take it. But this comes from Mel in Georgia, and this is her comment about an earlier discussion. You are probably more likely to get students interested in the subject if there was an actual PhD program or something for students to go to. As it stands, and remember, I'm speaking for someone who is trying to get into this area, but I'm labeled as a kook or a loon, or even in my own interdisciplinary space studies department, I'm not given any credibility or respect for wanting to pursue these topics. It's really hard to integrate this into social sciences when there are so few supporters of astrosociology or the subjects you're talking about today, and when academia doesn't seem to offer at any place a credible PhD program in the field. I think that there needs to be a lot of work within the discipline itself to show respectability to this field, and I honestly believe the students will flock to it. I have met many students that are interdisciplinary, and they don't want the engineering or the hard science or the math. They want the social studies and the psychology and some of the issues we're talking about today, but there's no place for them to go.
Well, that you know, for astrosociology as a movement, if you want to call it that, you know, the development of astrosociology is aimed at getting astrosociology into colleges and universities and high schools at some point. You know, it's going to be a very difficult road, but we realize that astrosociology isn't recognized. In my discipline of sociology, for example, there isn't even really a recognition that space is important to social life, even in terms of, you know, obvious things like spin-offs and those kinds of things that actually impact on society and you know, contribute to social change and so on. But you know, we are making progress, ironically, I guess, at on the other side of the ledger, which is with the space community. And we have, for example, a working group in the AIAA, and you know, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but at the space conference coming up in San Diego in September, we have three sessions that are going to be, you know, in the program, and I think that that's just, you know, a sign that we're convincing at least engineers and space scientists to some extent that the social sciences need to be recognized in a more formal way. We just need to put more pressure on sociology and the other social sciences, and the very existence or the very creation of astrosociology was done in order to fill a void that the social scientists were not recognizing.
I have a question along the same lines again from Tony, and by email, and he says, the perception I get from certain people opposed to space, besides the geek factor, is that space is a big waste of money. Don't you think that if space actually provided an economic service to people, like space solar power or maybe space tourism was readily available at a reasonable cost, that the detractors' attitude would change? And I will add on to Tony's comments that the disciplines that were willing to study and integrate space into their disciplines themselves would probably expand like light year speed if space were made relevant to people.
If I might, Dave, I'd like to just make one quick comment on Mel's question and then move on to this one.
Okay.
And it's absolutely correct that what you can do in psychology is you can try to find out where the relevant research is going on. And one way you can start is in, say, you know, clinical psychology, sociology, many other areas of psychology, possibly anthropology, is check out the National Space Biomedical Research Institute website. Find out that the National Space Biomedical Research Institute. Find out where the work is being done that's closest to your interest. It won't be exactly as your interest, but, you know, they're doing things on sleep and circadian rhythms and delivery of psychotherapy in space and all kinds of neat things. And then simply apply to the programs to work with that individual who's involved in that. And maybe tough to get in, but that's about the best point of entree in terms of getting a credential and then even getting a job afterwards. It's not just the lack of programs, it's the lack of positions afterwards. And psychology has a little bit of an edge there, I think, compared to some of the other disciplines because of the research going on. But it's very disheartening to find students who are willing to make that commitment for a PhD, and then they want to work in SETI or humans in space and say, gee, you know, we don't have a program, and if we did, I don't think I'd really want to take you because I don't know what would happen when it came time to get a job later. I have had a couple of students, graduate students, that succeeded. Barrett Caldwell being a really good example, but it gets to be very difficult. With respect to the economic argument, yes, I agree. The problem for me personally is simply that, yes, it's expensive. If we could reduce the cost, increase the rewards. I mean, I've read all kinds of stuff on it. I'm sure everybody else, probably including the caller, has. And it seems hard to make that transition there from speculation, hypotheses, analysis, and so forth to reality. I'm working on chapters for the history of psychology in the space program. So I was reading some of the older material, and I came across about a 1970 paper, and was it, I don't remember if it was Fletcher, who was the administrator then, but it was talking about what was going to happen in the 1980s and 90s, and it's all the kind of stuff we hear about today that hasn't happened, you know, $15 a pound, you know, three shuttle missions a week, whatever. And it just seems to never quite make that transition. It seems as if, I don't know if there's not enough support or it's simply more difficult than any of us who are interested in space or willing to admit or what. But it seems hard to turn these wishful, and I don't mean that in a negative way, wishful ideas about making it cheap, safe, and rewarding, you know, into something that actually works.
Jim, Tom is right. You're a wealth of information on this subject, and what you have on astrosociology.com is a phenomenal resource. You want to tell us a little bit about all of this?
Okay. We have a virtual library that has PDF copies of all our papers that we've presented over the years since we started this, as well as you know, a listing of publications. We had a couple of publications in astrosociology. Also, there's a calendar history page, and these are buttons that are accessible at the top of the either at the top of the page, the pages in terms of the buttons, or in the case of the calendar history page, it's accessible either on the home page at the top. There's a link there, and also on the community page. And for example, you know, in the history section of the calendar history page, I have a little blurb about the contact conference that we just did, and it has the listing of people that participated, as well as a link to the 2008 version of the contact site, which is now you know, the 2009 version. So this will allow people to get back to last week's show or conference and see who participated and, you know, whether they'd be interested in going to the next one, because I'm sure it will be pretty similar. And so what I've tried to do with astrosociology.com is provide the resources for people interested in the social science perspective in space research. And I think you know, in terms of the students not having anywhere to go or very few places to go to become astrosociologists or to become space researchers in other contexts, I think that that's something that we're definitely working on right now, and we're trying to get it to become a reality as soon as we can. But as people have realized, it's a tough road, and we're going to have some obstacles that we're going to have to overcome to make it possible. We're actually creating a field that doesn't exist or didn't exist when we started, that the social sciences don't necessarily respect or even acknowledge, and we're trying to get them to change their perspective on the need for space to be part of the social sciences.
Linda in Tucson says, Dr. Pass, do you have a plan to integrate astrosociology into the main field of sociology? How is your plan unfolding? Is it going well? And what are the primary barriers or the biggest barriers to mainstream sociology accepting astrosociology?
Okay, that's a great question. First, I want to state that astrosociology, despite its name, is also a multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary field, as well as a sociological subfield. So it's like has like a duality to it, in the sense that we're attracting all kinds of social scientists and humanities scholars and people in the arts, as well as sociologists. But in terms of sociology itself, there is a big barrier right now. We've, for example, the ASA is probably the biggest barrier, which is the American Sociological Association, which is the biggest national organization. And we've put in requests for special sessions at that conference for the last 3 years and have been denied. And so we have another one, you know, slated for 2009. And in fact, Margaret Race has volunteered to help us put together a revised petition for that for 2009 in order to try to, you know, make it more appealing to the sociologists who are in charge of, you know, making these decisions. It's important to realize that it's difficult to get new fields into an established social science because people have interests in maintaining their own subfields, and a new subfield is going to be just another source of competition for resources and bodies and so on. And so, you know, the fewer for them in terms of keeping the traditional subfields, the better. So we have that to overcome. So it's been very difficult. And so, like I said, you know, we've had more success on the space community side. And I'm hoping that at some point the space community will put some pressure on the social sciences. But that may be, you know, a while coming before that happens.
One of the things that Jim has really been working with this in a very intelligent and forceful way, but it's kind of an uphill battle. When SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, wanted to get social scientists involved, John Billingham, who was in charge of it pretty much at that time, his strategy was to try to get the biggest names possible associated with it. The idea being that once you got these leaders on board, everything else would fall into place. And the question becomes, you know, how do you get these big leaders on board? Well, if you got a lot of money, you can throw a conference and bring people together. And if you know what you're doing and really work at it, you get them to, you know, write some papers and so forth. But there's sort of these currents of themes in different disciplines tend to predominate, and it's seems very, very difficult. I'm wondering, Jim, if part of the problem is that, you know, when we mention it, people immediately start thinking about three people in the space station, and they don't understand, you know, the, you know, tens of thousands of people that were involved getting them there, and all these other kinds of things, you know, that we're really, really sensitive about.
I think that's part of it, and I think there's also the misperception of, among a lot of sociologists and members of other communities, that the space program is too costly, and you know they don't realize you know what the true expenses are, or the true percentage of the budget, that federal budget that NASA actually takes up. So I think you know we have a problem of even having a starting point at which some of these people, including seems most sociologists that I've come across, can come together at a mutual point where we can start a dialogue. It seems like there's already kind of an aloofness in which you know a lot of sociologists just don't even think of space as being either relevant or even legitimate as a subject matter.
It is a fear, you know, that I was taught, and I suspect you were too, you know, to make a pretty clear distinction between social science and social relevance, you know, and that, some research is action-oriented and stuff, but, you know, we're really trying to understand social phenomena and what's going to happen and what it means and stuff, but my impression from going to the social conventions with you and I will admit this is also true to a decent extent of psychology, is that a lot of people in our professions are somewhat action oriented, you know, so that their studies of feminist activities or whatever, you know, that yes, that's science, but they're also, you know, a member of a group that's action oriented, or poverty, or minorities or inner city slums or whatever, you know. So there's this sort of action orientation, and to them, that wouldn't be satisfied by something as future oriented and in space. So that's true. Then you know that really reinforces, I think, your argument about the competition over scarce resources.
Yeah, I think that's true, and you know, I think. Maybe what we need to do is we need to be more clear about how space activities can actually impact on helping to mitigate social problems, not just in space, but you know on Earth. You know, we have a lot of social problems that we're trying to deal with, including global warming and all kinds of other things. And we are using space resources, satellites and other things, to help to understand and mitigate the problem. But a lot of sociologists and others don't realize, you know, what's really going on in this area.
I have another question for you guys. This is Larry, and Larry's in Houston, Texas. And he says, I attend many space advocate conferences. In fact, that's the main type of space conference I attend. I find a complete lack of coverage of the social sciences at these conferences. Occasionally, something will show up like a focus on the overview effect, which I imagine would fall into the social science category. But there are probably other areas that might have a connection to social science, but they're not billed as social science, and the connection is not made either by the speaker or by anyone in the audience, such as having an attorney speak on property rights in space or property rights on the moon or something of that nature. I think that the industry, as well as the sociological industry or the academic community, is remiss in not being able to connect the dots and to bring the arguments together under some sort of an umbrella at the focal point of space advocacy conferences like ISDC, the Mars Society, Space Frontier Foundation, etc. Any comments, please?
I think it's a really good point. And I used to go to some advocacy conferences. I don't do it anymore. You know, you could say that Contact's an advocacy group in a way, too, but not the way these other ones are. And if there's not many other people that share your interest there, I mean, the audiences are always polite, and I think they genuinely appreciate, you know, some of the points that you try to raise. But it's hard for the emissaries from the social sciences to do that. There are some exceptions, but not with space advocacy groups. With certainly in astrobiology and SETI, you know, you get kind of a critical mass, you know, which makes it kind of fun and interesting. But,
I wrote my master's thesis on the international law of property rights on in outer space. And I've been teasing out the material into various papers for the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics over the past couple of years. And my talks have been fairly well received. I see a lot of interest there in the professional community. I really haven't delved into the advocacy community regarding this topic.
Yeah, I think there's a huge difference. When I go to an AIAA conference, for example, versus going to ISDC or Space Frontier or Mars Society, or I go to a professional conference like SmallSat or Responsive Space, we're talking about different worlds and different audiences and a different level of reality thinking. But that question from Larry was specifically geared toward the advocacy conferences and the advocacy audience. I think the others are all advocates as well, the professional conference and the professional environment is a totally different animal. And I think you have much better connections for this discipline in the professional arena than you do, for whatever reason, in the advocacy arena.
David?
Yes.
I just want to mention that in terms of the ISDC conference, last year we actually had an astrosociology session. And we're working to have another one this year.
How was it attended?
Pretty well. I think the room was three-quarters filled or so, which is pretty good for astrosociology. And also, another thing, is a lot of students actually attend the advocacy conferences. So it's a good chance to interact with students. And I think, you know, it's interesting to note that a lot of the students that I come into contact with, once I explain astrosociology to them, they become interested. But again, you know, right now they don't have anywhere to go to pursue it.
Yeah, like Mel said in Georgia. Well, maybe everyone should convene in Georgia and you should start your own school. Homeschooling for a PhD. You can be the dean, Jim.
Well, I think another aspect of the question had to do with the umbrella concept of bringing things together. And that's what I intended after sociology to do, by creating a brand name of sorts in the academic world, after sociology. My intention was, from the beginning, to have something that people can identify with. So to bring together the isolated social scientists and students together. And while I don't expect every space policy person or space law person or any other area to come into astrosociology to say, it is a way of, you know, bringing in at least guest speaker sessions and so on, so that people get an idea that, you know, all these issues are related to each other.
Here's a note for you gentlemen from Andrew in Tucson. This is a general point and a question for the guest and Dr. Livingston. Perhaps the professional space community shun social sciences and other fields because they are afraid other communities might say no. Spaceflight, especially human spaceflight, is very much in peril and can be turned off, a fact members of the community are aware of. In your interactions with the space community, have you had fear of rejection from your community articulated as a reason? How many from your community do you think would call for the closure of the space frontier if it were to become an issue in your field?
Well, in sociology, I think the majority of the members of the ASA would probably sign that petition at this point. So, you know, like I said, we have a difficult time ahead of us. But in the space community itself, I'm finding that there is more openness towards the idea of astrosociology and also, just in more general terms, the social sciences and humanities being relevant as the century unfolds. And we talk about settlements and a lot of other issues that impact on humans and their society.
Any other comments on Andrew's
I think
question?
The big hurdle to overcome in the social sciences community and in the society at large is this idea, this false idea, that the space program, and when I talk about the space program, I'm talking about the government space programs as opposed to commercial programs, that it's hugely expensive. They think that it's something on the order of, you know, funding the Iraq War, and that's simply false. If they realized that it was less than 1% of the total federal budget, and what a tremendous bargain we were getting for that money spent, I think there would be less resistance to the space program, and there'd be more support for it.
This is a question from Barbara in Mesa, Arizona, and she says, gentlemen, we have a presidential candidate who has said in a public speech that because NASA is not sufficiently inspiring anymore, that the NASA budget should go in his administration to funding his version of STEM education. So this seems to me to be a total disconnect with space, what it does for education, as well as what it does for inspiration, because while it may not be quite as inspiring as in the days of the Cold War and racing to the moon, certainly the Mars rovers have proven to be showstoppers and have the biggest hits of record on the internet. The Hubble telescope is unbelievable, and the list goes on and on and on. But if this is a policy being advocated by one of our presidential candidates and a top person at that in the Senate, this shows a total lack of connection of space with education, with motivation, with inspiration, with everything we're talking about today. This is almost a hopeless predicament.
Well, you know, this has come up in recent discussions, you know, informal discussions, I think, that lots of people have had. And you know, I'm going to confess right up front that I don't favor voting or against any one candidate on the basis of any one issue. But in this particular case, I think there's a lot of hope that some rapid education, you know, might make the person a little bit more receptive. Unfortunately, NASA does have a lot of problems, and they just tend to be high profile. But it still does good work and has a good program. So I don't have much to say other than you know, that it's quite possibly, you know, research and education might soften the view somewhat. And again, you know,
I would say that. Yeah, again, don't cast your vote one way or the other on a single issue. But what people can do, and everybody that's listening to this program, you have to become a political activist on this issue. You know, go and meet with your representative from Congress. Don't just write letters. You can do that too. I mean, at least do something. But the best thing is to go and meet with your congressman and talk to him or her about the importance of the space program. Now, David, you and I live in the California 6th District, and you know that, you know, what other merits Representative Lynn Woolsey may have, she has a terrible record on the space program. And she sits on the Science Committee in the House, which is the parent committee of the subcommittee on space.
And she's a member of the Democratic Party, which is in control right now.
Right. Right. But we need to go and talk to her and do it repeatedly and educate her on this, because she thinks that sending people to Mars is a total waste of money.
Well, at least she's not as bad as the one in Texas who thinks we've already been to Mars.
Maybe that particular member of Texas has been to Mars.
You know, I have a different take on this with, and by the way, this is a comment, this is a speech and a Q&A that Senator Obama did in Wyoming that the caller is referring to, and I'm not really going after politics here. But for somebody in the Senate to have this perception of space and NASA tells me that we in the industry, we in NASA, those who are advocating sociology or anything else related with space, have really not done a good job. First, I'd want to know how he defines inspiration. And I'd love to know his feelings when Pathfinder landed on Mars on July 4th a number of years ago, and plus a bunch of other, you know, missions that have gone down that have just been incredibly fabulous and inspiring. Even some of the amazing things that our astronauts have done with resumption of flight with the shuttle and et cetera. But aside from his idea of inspiration, if this is how we're communicating to our leading politicians in the Senate, in the House, across the board, and to probably millions and millions of Americans who absolutely agree with this position, we got our work to do, people. We are the ones that know, the ones that have the potential to be the leader. We are disconnecting with our fellow citizens and our elected members of Congress. Now, I don't pretend to have an answer for it, but this to me is a reflection right back in the mirror of just how probably incestuous and speaking to the choir and Kool-Aid-y we have been, while totally ignoring that there is a general society out there and there are people that aren't space cadets with Kool-Aid running through their veins that probably want to see space justified, that probably want to know why we're doing anything in space. And we don't help along that cause. So I see this as a reflection back to us, as a red flag that we in the industry, we that are the advocates, the supporters, the scientists, the social scientists, the media people, we're not doing a very good job with our fellow citizens and our members of Congress.
Amen.
Yeah, right.
David?
Yeah.
I think one of the things that we need to do is we need to, you know, actually provide a way for students to have a place to study space and participate in space research, so that, you know, if you think about it, if you're talking about leaving out almost an entire branch of science in space research, if you can just bring in the social scientists, the humanities scholars, you know, students in those, and even in the arts, you're going to have a situation in which you're going to have potentially double the number of people who are putting pressure on government to do exactly what we think they should, which is to expand, not just maintain the space program. And so I think, you know, we need to do it from both directions. I concur with Tom in terms of, you know, contacting government representatives and so on, but we also need to do it from other sources, you know, from the bottom up. In this case, we need to do it from, you know, the academic side.
Well, I don't know how we get a university to start a program. You know, I was obviously joking with a homeschooled PhD. That's not going to fly. But clearly,
I don't know about that.
How do you do a homeschool PhD?
Well,
and
maybe at some point we could have a internet-based,
a distance learning course. One. Well, that's possible. Tom, I have an idea. Since you and I are virtually neighbors within probably 40 miles of each other, why don't you and I and Marilyn make an appointment to get to a senior staffer in Woolsey's regional office, and let's go up and talk to him. And I'll bring my space show tape recorder with me and tell him that not only are we there to lobby and talk about space, but this is a space show program because we really think the public deserves to hear from the staff that is paid for out of our tax dollars, and to let us know what staffers and what members of Congress really think about some of these programs that are dear to our community's heart. And they'll either say, you can't record us, or, you know, or they'll allow us to record them, but at least we'll have our meeting. How say you? You think the three of us could make an appointment and go up there together and talk to someone in Woolsey's office?
I was actually thinking along those lines. I'm glad you said it. Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it, and let's set it up after the show or the first of the week and find a time we can do it and when a senior staffer is available to talk to us. And then we'll all come on the space show, and we'll report what happens when we go in there to a senior member of the Science and Technology Committee who is not a big space cadet. So, gentlemen, we are at the end of the show. Closing and concluding remarks from all three of you, and who wants to give out email address for further contact, or who wants to be contacted through me if anyone wants to ask further questions of you?
This is Jim. People can contact me at jpath at astrosociology.com. And anybody who's interested in the social sciences, whether you're a student or a professional, I would like you to contact me, and maybe we can do something in the future in terms of either you know, working together or finding avenues for you as a student to you know, get ahead in the area of astrosociology before we can establish it as a field.
Okay, Al.
Yeah, Al Harrison. I enjoyed it. I'm wondering if there's any way we can get Tom on the ballot president this fall. But barring that, I hope to work with you on increasing interest. Anybody can contact me at A.A. Harrison. That's A-A-H-A-R-R-I-S-O-N at UC Davis, or one word, .edu.
We can certainly write their names in on the ballot. It's probably too late to get them in on the official ballot. But, you know, if we're frustrated with our choices, Tom, Jim, you, maybe I can write all three of you in. There we have Secretary of State, VP, and President. You guys can rotate from time to time. How's that?
Sounds good. I think I ought to start with Congress first, though. Get a little experience.
Well, maybe you can replace our illustrious 6th district member. Your comments, Tom.
Okay. People can reach me at TEG, that's Tango Echo Golf, at OPS, as in Oscar Papa Sierra, dash Alaska, like the state, .com.
Boy, we don't get the fighter jet jock out of you at all, do we?
No, negative, not at all.
It's still there. Any concluding comments or pearls of wisdom?
It's been a great experience, as usual. Thanks very much for having me on.
Tom,
one final comment. I think that if we get the Orion program to go and we actually get humans back to the moon, interest in manned space flight is going to pick up. I think the space shuttle and the space station have kind of made space boring for people for the past few decades. And, you know, what Apollo did for education, I think Orion has the potential to do the same thing. And I think we'll see things picking up if we can keep Orion alive to get there.
Guys, I want to hold you on because you just triggered something else I wanted to say, because part of what the good senator said in his Wyoming speech was that is exactly what the space community has wanted to happen. It is as if we have, you know, shot ourselves in the foot because the rest of the population is ignorant. But what he said was that look, when we were going to the moon, people tuned on the TV. Everybody wanted to see a rocket launch. We knew the names of all the astronauts. I mean, this was like first page news. Everybody in grade school, junior high, high school, everything. We all knew all of this. We couldn't get enough of it. We had shows dedicated to showing us how the rockets work. He says, now a shuttle goes off, we hardly ever watch it. You know, we're lucky if the network breaks to the actual launch 30 seconds before it lifts off or lands. None of us know the names of the crew members. None of us know what's going on and what they're really doing with the ISS. Damn it, this is what the space community has wanted. We want space to be the routine. We don't want it to be the exception, because when it is the routine, we have the opportunity for lower costs. We have the opportunity for commercial development. We have all sorts of opportunities that happen when an industry starts to be routine rather than unique and standalone and special and needing a lot of TLC and everything else. So here he is citing the very, very things that the space community has strived for to make space an everyday occurrence so we can be spacefaring. And he is holding that out as why he is no longer inspired and why he needs to steal from the NASA budget to go fund education. And I don't have an answer for that. It's like we have shot ourselves in the foot with this segment of intelligence by being successful.
I think you have to have both.
Yeah.
You have to have both the routine day-to-day stuff, you know, where you're just downstreaming a lot of science from Earth orbit and from other sources, and it's not very spectacular, it's not sexy. But you also have to have a flashy flagship program that inspires people. And if you have that flashy flagship program, yeah, it's more expensive, but it also creates political support for these other more mundane things that are more practical to be done in space. So So I think having both is really the best mix.
Any comments from any from the other?
I think NASA's approach for fire was going to be that they would always be at the cutting edge in the front, and then commercial interests, other things would come along to sort of fill in behind. So they would be the explorers. I think the problem we've got now, it's sort of like going to a musical and they keep playing the overture but don't open the curtain. We have to have, say slightly differently what Tom says, we have to have some kind of a show, or to get back to the old phrase, no Buck Rogers, no Bucks. I think there's lots of inspirational things that could be done. Unfortunately, they're expensive.
Jim, you're...
Dave?
Yes.
I think, first I want to thank you for having us on the show. It's been very enjoyable and very interesting.
Always an honor to have all of you join us. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we should consider the fact that the space program is in a different category compared to other programs in the government. Why is it that the space program has to have a flashy program while spending in other areas doesn't have the same kind of need? So I'm not saying that it's not necessary, but I'm just saying that we should think about the fact that space seems to be in a different category in terms of how its value is measured.
I agree, and I think we need to pause and think again, and maybe we do need to have the two working side by side, but when our very goals of routine are used against us to make space boring and uninspiring and to be no longer worthy of the national budget, which is minuscule to begin with, we have, again, you know, we're major disconnecting with members of Congress and the American people. That routineness should be an asset for us to show that, look, space is developing. Space is worthy of investment money. Space is worthy of our tax dollar investment. I mean, instead of being used against us to take away our budget and our programs, which we all know are vital to our survival for a better humanity here on Earth. So anyone want the last word, or do I end up with it?
Sounds like you just ended it.
I just want to say we have our work cut out for it.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, always a pleasure, and I look forward to your coming back. Al, you actually have a fairly new book out there. You want to plug it real quick for us?
No.
Because I forgot to mention it.
You caught me. It's called Starstruck. You just caught me by surprise. It's called Starstruck, Cosmic Visions in Science, Religion, and Folklore. It tries to tie together astrobiology and SETI, UFOs, space exploration, and planetary defense. And the theme is how all these things are contributing to new ways of thinking about things and new answers to old existential questions like who am I, how did I get here, and what's going to happen next. And it's been a very low-profile book. It's only had one review so far. I know there's another one coming. But individual readers, at least those who have contacted me and put things up on Amazon, seem to like it. And it's my attempt to come to grips with how other people are coming to grips with our place in the universe. And I had fun putting it together, and I hope more people take time to learn about its content. Again, it's called Starstruck, Cosmic Visions in Science, Religion, and Folklore, and it's published by Berghahn, B-E-R-G-H-A-H-N, Berghahn Press, that is a specialist in anthropological books.
And listeners, the last time Al was on the show, we talked about this book, so you can do guest search and Google Al's name, and you'll find the show about that book. I have a copy. I've read it. I urge all of you to get it. It will answer some of your questions and give you a lot more questions, and it is well worth the read. And I think you'll see why Dr. Harrison is a unique and special asset to our community. Gentlemen, always a pleasure.
Can I plug my book for a second?
Absolutely. I didn't know you had a book.
Oh, yeah. And it's not a space cadet book. It's a political science book. It's called From the Primaries to the Polls, How to Repair America's Broken Presidential Nomination Process. I think that's pretty timely considering the ongoing battle in the Democratic Party. And it is published by Prager.
And it is repairable, or did you say we have to give up?
Oh, no, no. I have a way of repairing it. It's a comprehensive reform. It would require the cooperation of the two major political parties, which is difficult to do, but it's not impossible to do. I think the political will is developing to do this, and we might see, if not in 2012, possibly in 2016, a comprehensive reform to do this in a much more rational way.
Thank you, Tom. I was not aware of that. I'm glad you brought it to our attention. Listeners, that's it for this Space Show program. Come back tomorrow, and Joanne Grabinowitz is our guest tomorrow. Tuesday will be a few recordings from Yuri's Night that I was able to do, notwithstanding some of the circumstances there. And then on for the rest of the week's program, we're back to a normal week on the Space Show. Thank you all for listening, and special thanks to Jim, Al, and Tom for joining us. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.